Welcome to Lady Killers, a podcast about female serial killers. I am your host, Abraham Archambault. Let's go dig up some bodies. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Lady Killers for this week. I hope you're all doing well out there. The only piece of news I have to report this week is that my screenplay, Loon Lake, is available on Amazon for a limited time right now. It's at a discounted price for the upcoming holidays. So if you're interested in reading my screenplay, Loon Lake, before it comes out as a film next year, go ahead and head over to Amazon to check that out. It's a nice, scary horror story. You can stay inside, stay warm, read that during these cold days of impending winter that are coming. Let me know what you think after you're done reading that, if you like. You can always visit our website at 1129productions.com and leave us a comment or send us an email from there as well. For this week's episode, I think it's best if we just dive right into it. I will remind all of you... And warn all of you out there that this is a podcast about serial killers, and it may not be suitable for all you listeners out there. Please use discretion if you're a little squeamish when it comes to talk of murder or blood. In this case, it is lots and lots of blood and body parts. So please use discretion. The previous episodes of Lady Killers involved murders mostly by poisoning, smothering, or forced drug overdoses. And this was all very common among the many women serial killers that have existed throughout the history of the United States, but this week is going to be different. I've received a few emails asking when we're going to start talking about some of the slashers that exist in the female serial killer world. And since that is what my screenplay, Loon Lake, is kind of about, this week, your wish has been granted. This story you're about to hear involves an axe. This week, we finally will study a killer that is extremely violent, a bloody murderer, and she does hail from way down south in the swamps of Louisiana. And our lady killer for this week is none other than Clementine Barnabet. Clementine Barnabet was an African-American girl born sometime around 1894 in St. Martinville, Louisiana. Her parents were Raymond Barnabet and Nina Porter. If you are familiar with Louisiana and how it's laid out, St. Martinville is about 140 miles west of New Orleans. So if you want to kind of picture that in your mind, you'll be able to tell where she's from. Clementine, she only had one other sibling. It was a brother by the name of Zephyrin. And as is the case with many of the episodes that we've been doing on this podcast, not much is known about her life before their family moved up to Lafayette in 1909 and before all of this madness starts to unfold that you're about to hear. All we really know about her childhood, all that was certain, is that her father was an extremely aggressive man and he was known to be abusive to the two children. And that's also another commonality between the serial killers that we have been studying so far. And since we don't know much about her formative years in St. Martinville, we pretty much just have to just dive headlong into this story. And it gets pretty wild and crazy almost immediately. Now, at the time of their move to Lafayette, Clementine was 15 years old. And not long after the Barnabets arrived in Lafayette, their father Raymond became very intrigued by a local group of black religious fanatics who called themselves the Church of Sacrifice. I looked up the Church of Sacrifice and couldn't really find much information about it. A lot of the information provided said it never even existed. It was something that was made up. Maybe it was just some little church or cult that was created at that time and maybe it just no longer exists anymore, or nothing has been found out about it, so we can't really discuss much about it. All that I know about it that was found out and written about Raymond and Clementine is that the main tenet of this religion was that by taking another person's life, they could achieve physical immortality. So they could, you know, suck their essence out or their soul out, I guess, by killing them. They could live forever. And Raymond, who was known to be a violent man, he heard that. He got real excited, and he joined that church soon after discovering them in Lafayette. And it seemed like a perfect fit, a violent man and a violent church group joining forces together. What more could you ask for? So the family, the Barnabets, would have been living in Lafayette for about 2 years before all of a sudden they were strewn all over the newspapers and they were thrust right into the middle of some murder investigations. There was a legend that was passing through the region of a vicious voodoo priestess and a cult that liked to butcher people by using an axe. So when the first murder happened in early January of 1911, all eyes focused on the Church of Sacrifice. Early one afternoon in that January in West Crowley, Louisiana, police were notified by a neighbor that something horrible had possibly occurred next door at 605 Western Avenue. They said there was a terrible odor of something that was dead and rotting, and they really think police should head over there and check it out to make sure that their neighbors were okay. So an officer was sent out by the name of Ballou to the residence to check on the occupants of the Byers family, who lived at 605 Western Avenue. A man by the name of Walter, his wife Sylvania, and their young boy were all found lying in a bed with their skulls split open. Officer Ballou is the one to find these, and he had said that the bed was stained a dark red, filled with the blood of the three victims. The floor surrounding the bed was caked with bloody footprints, presumably the murderer, and in one corner of the room there was a bucket that was filled to the brim with blood. And they didn't really need to look too far to find any murder weapon, because right there at the head of the bed, just above the three dead bodies, was that murder weapon, a bloody axe. Police weren't too surprised by this crime. That area was pretty poor, so it wasn't too much of a surprise, but what they were surprised by was the brutality of the crime. They said it was one of the most heinous and gruesome crimes to ever happen in that region. And unfortunately for the residents of the area, this would be the beginning of a bloody rampage that would be perpetrated by this Church of Sacrifice. A cult is what I would call it. They butchered their victims as part of some sort of religious rite. And, you know, this murderer sent all of these residents quickly into a panic. The murder of Walter Byers and his family, it really confused and baffled the police, because Walter, he didn't have any known enemies. He was far from being rich. He was far from wealthy. So there was no motive for this heinous crime that they could find. And the authorities were just completely baffled by the murders, and they chalked it up to a racist killer, since the Byers were black. And that was a common occurrence at the time in that area. A lot of racist murders were occurring. But the police had no solid leads, and basically there was no evidence, so they closed that case without any arrest being made. Now, some claim that this wasn't the first murder by that cult, the Church of Sacrifice, and they claim the first murderer was actually a woman named Edna Opelousas and her three children. They were killed outside Rain, Louisiana in November of 1909. There was no evidence or proof ever found that it would have been connected, that there was the same murderer involved in that. The only fact that they had was that all the victims were beheaded and dismembered, possibly with an axe. It's a possibility that this was the first murder associated with the case, since this would have been just months after the Barnabet family arrived in the region, and it was just after Raymond had joined the Church of Sacrifice, but it was never really proven, so they weren't connected. But in any event, things returned to normal until about a month later on the 25th of February, when four members of the Andrus family, Father Alexander, Mother Mimi, and their two children, were found slaughtered in Lafayette. Authorities claim that this case led them to believe it was connected to the Byers murders, since the murders were so similar in fashion. The coroner ruled that all of them were killed by some sort of blunt object, most likely the end of an axe, the blunt end of the axe, not the blade, which they had found at the scene. All of their heads were smashed into oblivion, and their brains and brain matter were splattered all around the room. All of the bodies had been terribly tortured before their heads were bashed in with that axe. And the manner that the police found the bodies was very disturbing. Alexander and Mimi were found in a kneeling position, and Mimi had her arm draped lovingly around her husband. And they said it looked as though they were praying to something. And then just in front of those two kneeling parents on the bed were the two babies lying mutilated. The authorities reportedly said that the scene was very peaceful and serene looking, if you could just look past all the blood and all the brains that had exploded throughout the room. You know, nothing was stolen or out of place, so robbery was not a motive. And it did appear that someone had done this just for no other reason than to steal people's lives. A few false leads came in, and this that took the police away from the area into Pineville, which was about 80 miles away. There was an escaped lunatic by the name of Garcon Godfrey. Apparently, it's something that he could have been involved in, they thought maybe. But he had a rock-solid alibi, and he was returned to the asylum that he had escaped from. And a few more murder cases were reported over it west, over in Texas, but nothing came of those either. Okay, so we head back over to Lafayette, Louisiana, to Raymond Barnabet. He had become a suspect because his mistress, she had become angry with him after some sort of fight or altercation that they had had. And this mistress is the one that led the police to him to start investigating and questioning him. Apparently, she had mentioned to one of her friends in passing that he was a pretty creepy guy, and he might have said something to her that might have implicated him in the axe murders that had been happening around town. And she was angry with him after that fight, and she just wanted to try to get him back. Just her telling the authorities this was enough to get them involved and to start investigating Raymond. He wasn't just some random suspect either. He was known around town as a petty thief, and he lived in the, quote, back part of town, which I looked that up and tried to find out what back part of town meant. And to me, it seems like it meant the rough part of town, and that he was living there, living a questionable life. And while Raymond was being investigated, another murder happened in March of 1911. Alfred and Elizabeth Cassaway, their three children, and a nephew of theirs were all found slaughtered in their home. Now, this actually caused the case to take a weird turn, since the Cassaway family had a white mother. Every other victim in this case up to this point that was slaughtered and chopped up, they were all black. And this was different, since the mother, Cassaway, was white. So it changed things a little bit. But Raymond, since he was already a suspect, he didn't have an alibi for these murders, and so he was arrested and he was sent to Lafayette Parish Jail. Now, Raymond's family, when they were approached by authorities, they claimed that he would disappear at night sometimes with no explanation whatsoever. And when he did finally return, his clothes and his shoes would be covered in blood and brain matter. Clementine's brother, Zephyrin, claimed his father would brag about murdering families, and he would say they deserve to die. That's why he was doing it. And as he would confess to his son, he would always have blood all over his clothes. And Zephyrin also stated that his father boasted about murdering the entire Andrus family. Now this would be enough to this would be enough evidence to arrest Raymond Barnabet, which they promptly did. And the trial for Raymond would begin in October of 1911, and his children were the star witnesses in this case, because they both claimed he would return home and he would violently threaten all of them. While doing this, he would be covered in blood and brains. And both of the children claimed they feared for their life always, and they would continually fear for their life if he was ever set free. In November of 1911, while Raymond sat in his jail cell, another murder occurred. This time, it was Norbert and Asima Randall that were found murdered along with their four children. And this case very eerily resembled the previous murders. One difference was found at this household, though. All of them were hacked to bits with an axe, except for the father, Norbert, who was shot in the back of the head. Now, since Raymond was already behind bars at the time of these murders, they knew that there was another suspect out there at large. And this would bring them all the way back to the Barnabet residence, where they started to focus in on Clementine and her brother Zephyrin, because somehow they had an inkling that, and they believed that the children had picked up where their father had left off. They also returned to the Barnabet household because one of the officials remembered finding traces of blood on one of Clementine's dresses. She claimed her father had smeared it there when he returned one night. But since there were still murders happening, they might as well go pay a visit to the Barnabets again and check them out, because it was known around town that the Barnabet children, they were kind of horrible children from all reports here. And they had some neighbors. Their last name was Stevens. So the Stevens family, they were quoted as calling them filthy, shifty, and degenerate children. So you mix that with some blood that was found on one of Clementine's dresses, and, let's go pay them a visit, see what's going on over at the Barnabet house. So this visit did turn out to benefit the police. Upon a more thorough search of the Barnabet house, they found a full getup of women's garb, covered in blood and brain matter. The latch on the door to the house was also covered in blood. And so, Clementine just laughed it all off. She said she had no idea how those clothes got in there. And they questioned Zephyrin, her brother, and he had a tight alibi, and it was all confirmed. Clementine was the only one that could not confirm her whereabouts the night of any of the murders that had happened. And some people also claimed they had seen a woman creeping around the cabin where the Randall massacre happened. And she vehemently denied any involvement in these murders. But at any rate, she was still arrested on the spot and she was taken away to jail anyway. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/ladykillers. With over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For all you listeners of the Lady Killers podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, I just finished reading the unabridged version of The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien, and I have to say it is better than it's ever been. I was recently on a road trip, and I really felt swept away into the fantasy in that book. I felt like I was along on the journey with those characters in the story. But if the fantasy genre is not what you're looking for, if you're looking for a thriller to go along with some of your serial killers, why not try out The Girl on the Train? That is another solid choice. But it's entirely up to you. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/ladykillers. Again, that's audibletrial.com/ladykillers for your free audiobook. So, even with Raymond and Clementine behind bars, murders continued to occur. In January of 1912, three more families were slain. The third family, the Broussard family, were all found in a similar fashion. Their hands were splayed out with pieces of wood to hold the fingers apart in the shape of a number 5. And then on the wall, written in blood, was, quote, "When he maketh the inquisition for blood, he forgetteth not the cry of the humble," end quote. Now that is a version of Psalm number 9 from the King James Bible. The message was signed by Human 5. So this led police to believe they had 5 murderers at large committing these horrible acts. And now they were looking for the Human 5 gang, as they were called in the newspapers. And among many of the victims, a common thread started to be found there during the investigation, and that was that many of them belonged to the Church of Sacrifice. This church claimed they were an offshoot of Christ Sanctified Holy Church, which was run by the Reverend King Harris. He was a Pentecostal revival preacher, and police heard about this, so he was brought in for interrogation by the authorities, but he denied ever even hearing of a place called the Church of Sacrifice. And he was actually said to be visibly shaken at the fact that anything that had escaped his mouth would cause these axe murderers. Not only was it said that the Church of Sacrifice was responsible for the killings, but it was also discovered that Clementine Barnabet was the leader of this cult. All of the murders that were being committed while Clementine was behind bars were done in her name or her honor. This is where the case actually kind of reminds me of Charles Manson and the Manson family. You know, he was directing murders, not committing them himself, but he was brainwashing his followers enough to where they would follow through with all of the things he was directing. And Clementine was that way, it seemed like. You know, she could be behind bars and she could still have the power as this voodoo priestess to still tell people what to do and have them go do it without question. And many of the newspapers started to connect these murders with a voodoo ritual of human sacrifice. And so now the name of this cult was starting to make sense. Church of Sacrifice. I always assumed it was, had to do with Jesus Christ, but they were actually sacrificing humans in order to gain their essence and live forever. All of this under the direction of Clementine from her jail cell. So apparently, after Clementine started reading all this in the papers, this was enough to wake her up. And so she started to spill her guts in April of 1912. She confessed to 17 murders that she had actually committed herself. All the others, she claimed, she was merely the director, like what Manson did. So that would bring the total up to 35 that she was involved in. And she claimed that she had bought a voodoo charm, or something in a conjure bag, it was called. There's a technical term that I can't pronounce, but it was a voodoo charm. Supposedly, this would protect her, make her invincible as well as invisible while she would be carrying out these murderous deeds. And the reason she committed her first murder, she said, was because she wanted to test out that theory to see if she would be invincible and invisible. And she did that, and she killed her first victims. One interesting fact, this also seems kind of like the Manson family a little bit. She would gather all of her followers together, and they would basically draw straws to see who was going to be committing the murders that night. And another fact about her is she said she would dress like a man and she would prowl around at night because it was easier to avoid detection if you were a man at night. So that's an interesting fact about, you know, about women serial killers in general. They still have, you know, to pretend like they're a man to get what they want. On April 5th, 1912, the Lafayette Advertiser printed Clementine's full confession. She admitted that her first murder was actually that first murder up in Rain, Louisiana that I had mentioned at the beginning of this podcast. She wanted it to be known that she didn't do it all alone either, but that she had many, many followers that would carry out all of these deeds that she asked for, including her father and her brother. So she's saying that she is the one that told her father and brother to kill, brainwashing them or putting some sort of voodoo hex on them to get them to kill for her. Because like I said, she truly believed that human sacrifice was the path to immortality. But she was also killing innocent children. And when she was asked why she was killing these innocent children, she claimed she didn't want to leave them as orphans in this horrible world. And she didn't want them to suffer. So she just ended it for them. She also outed the voodoo priest that she claimed gave her these conjure bags full of charms that would cause her to be invisible or invincible or both. His name was Joseph Thibodeau. She also claimed that all the murders were his idea. So now here we are, after she's already been busted, she decides she's going to start trying to throw other people under the bus. So she claims this guy, Joseph Thibodeau, was some sort of voodoo priest and that he had told her to commit all these murders. He, of course, denied it all. He claimed he wasn't involved in voodoo in any way whatsoever. He was only involved in root-based medicine. Anything that she did, he thinks that Clementine, like in the case with Reverend King Harris, acted alone. You know, she might have heard a couple words or something uttered by one of them, and then she just ran with it. She borrowed simple and harmless ideas, and she turned them into sadistic, ritualistic murders that plagued that area of Louisiana at the time. After all this wild and crazy talk about voodoo and different charms and amulets, Clementine was still found sane and able to stand trial. She was quickly convicted and sentenced to life in prison in October of 1912. She would be confined to the infamous Angola State Penitentiary. In July of the following year, she tried to escape from prison, but she was easily caught. 10 years later, she finally succeeded in getting out of prison. She was deemed rehabilitated after a procedure restored her sanity. And that's in quotes. To me, that sounds kind of like a lobotomy would have been if they restored her sanity by some sort of procedure. After they had done that, they said she was good to go. So she walked out the front doors of that prison. And according to reports, she changed her name. She moved far away, and she was never seen or heard from again. But of course, in cases like this, wild theories are concocted and stories are told about the legend of Clementine Barnabet. It has been said that she continued practicing voodoo and that she was involved in these crazy sex orgies where they would sacrifice people and, you know, eyes wide shut sort of things. One intriguing story popped up in 2002, though, that I find it fascinating. There was someone online that went by the name Voodoo Gal 11, who purported her great-grandmother knew entirely too much about these murders and some of the specifics of the case. She also stated that she bore an eerily similar resemblance to all the photos that she had ever seen of Clementine. That particular great-grandmother lived to be 104 years old. Maybe it was her, maybe not. In reality, though, nothing much is known about her or her church after she left prison. And that is the story of the axe-murdering Clementine Barnabet, voodoo priestess and cult leader. That's Lady Killers for this week. I am your host, Abraham Archambault. I hope you have sweet dreams.